You are listening to Hidden Now Heard, the podcast of the Mancap Cymru Heritage Lottery funded project, also supported by the Welsh Government. We are collecting the oral histories of people with a learning disability who lived in long-stay hospitals across Wales, along with the staff who cared for them. You may know them as institutions or asylums. You will hear lots of historical terms in the interviews, but try not to judge those who used them. Don't judge those who are part of the system. Judge the system itself. Eddie trained at Brynwen Leiaf in the early 1980s and remained until the 1990s. During his time there, he worked on many wards with many people. As you will hear, he keeps bumping into old residents in the community today. This oral history was recorded on 14th July 2016. Today's interview was conducted by my colleague Paul Hunt.
My name is Eddie Cox. I'm a former nurse at Brynwen Leiaf Hospital, Llanfairpwll, from 1975 to 1991.
Eddie, how did you come to work at Brynwen Leiaf?
I was working in St David's Hospital in Bangor after having left the army, and the School of Nursing were recruiting staff. And I'd gone down, because my girlfriend at the time was a student nurse, and I was asked, would I fancy going nursing? And I went down to see David Jones, who was the head tutor at the time. And while I was there waiting, I saw pamphlets of Rampton and Moss Side Hospital. And I thought, ooh, I've read leaflets and I fancied doing that. And he was disappointed with me that I didn't want to go and do general nursing. But he persuaded me to go to Brynwen Leiaf to do a test to see if I was suitable. I went to Brynwen Leiaf around about January of 1975 and sat an entrance test and was successful in getting the post, becoming a pupil nurse, which was a two-year course, which I failed first time.
Did you know anything about learning disability prior going to Brynwen Leiaf?
I'd done a little bit of research. My mother had a miscarriage and she had lost a baby who was born with Down syndrome. So I did a bit of work, research into that, and sort of thinking, this looks interesting.
Where are you from originally?
Bangor.
Sorry, Bangor. So were you aware of Brynwen Leiaf Hospital?
Brynwen Leiaf didn't exist when I started. I found out when I got to Brynwen Leiaf about Oakwood Park and various places, satellite units. There was a place in Carnarvon, various other little places, but I didn't really know about Brynwen Leiaf. Didn't even know about Llanfairpwll, I don't think.
So could you describe the hospital grounds for me?
The hospital grounds, it was something like a 15, 20 acre area with the drive going down into the hospital with trees down the middle and on the left hand side, and there was a drive going down and a drive coming up. There were 20 wards. 1, 2, 3, and 4 were double story wards, upstairs, downstairs, and then there was 5, 6, which is a walled ward. There's a 12-foot wall around the compound on the back.
Why was there a wall around it?
The people that resided there were what was classed when I started. The people were categorised as subnormal and severely subnormal, and the people that resided in Villa 5 were severely subnormal, although Villa 6 were more able and were used to go out to work daily, but 5 was a locked ward.
Was that because they had what we call challenging behaviour today, or something?
But they were a danger to themselves. A lot of very challenging behaviour. It was the first ward that I went on when I finished my 3 months in in school. The other wards, going up to 20, and then there was PGU, which is Parents Guidance Unit, and young children were there. And then there were two workshops, a male workshop and a female workshop. And one of the best things that happened there was somebody set fire to the female workshops, and it made it, they had to mix males and female work together for the first time. I think it was around about late 70s, early 80s that happened. And then there was the main hall, which was a stage there where we used to have cinemas, church every week, concerts, pantos that the staff used to hold, and it was used as a badminton court.
So what were your impressions the first time you stepped onto a ward?
I was kicking myself because everybody on my group had gone, was employed as nursing assistants prior to starting the training. I just went in there on the 4th of May and started on the 5th of May. And I wasn't, I'd had no insight into, I didn't go around and work there at all. I had one trip around the grounds with Mr. Northall, who was the admin nursing officer. And so I had a room, moved into the nurse's home, and started my training.
So how did you feel at the end of your first day?
It was excited. It was there was a lot of people. There was about 12 in our group. We got to meet each other, and we all came from different backgrounds. But we all gelled in the end. I think it was 12 of us. And 10 of us failed our exams on the first attempt.
Do you have to do the entire course again, or just
no?
Reset?
No, I resat, and 6 months later, and I passed. And then,
so what did that initial 2-year period, the training period, entail?
My first ward was Villa 5. Like I said, it was challenging. It was you were given a white coat and an orange stick with a zinc oxide tape, which you had to tape together and keep in your top pocket. So if anybody had a fit, you stuck it in their mouth and stopped them biting their tongue, which is all hogwash now. And I remember having to go through it was 3 months there, and about every 6 weeks I went through a pair of shoes because they just rotted because of the urine that was on the floor. It was just, you know, it was getting clean then, but it was just perishing your shoes. And it was challenging. I was taught what to do, what not to do. A couple of things I didn't listen. And there's a gentleman who was in his swimming trunks all day. He wouldn't wear clothes. And I was taught, whenever you dress him, toilet him, you do it from behind. And I did, but he span round and kneed me in the nose. Buff, and I had blood, and everybody laughed. That was my induction after about the second week. My second induction was, I was told to go and clean up a lump of faeces that was left on the floor. And when I come back, it had gone. And somebody was eating it. And I was then I was sort of beginning to wonder, what am I doing here? But we got on, me and the people I was looking after, and I got on with the staff.
And what was the layout of that ward?
There was the main day room, which you ate and lounged around. There was a television in the corner, in the top, with the screen, had to be with the perspex on top of it. That went on in the evening, and I think television finished about half ten at night those days.
Who decided what to watch?
The charge nurse. He was a bit of a character, the charge nurse. Then you went from the day room, you had various, there's a little side room, which somebody slept in if they were ill or something, or if they were secluded for some reason during the day, or you went out into the yard, tarmac yard, with this big wall around it. Then there was an office and what they called the duty station, and it was right in the middle of the ward. And the point of it was, when you were on nights, you sat there and you saw everywhere. You could see everything. You could see the office, the room behind the office, the door going out, the dormitory, because all the dormitories at that point were open. They had little walls about yay high, so if anything happened, you would see it down the toilet area, day room. Then you went down toilet area. You had one shower room, sluice room, staff locker room, and cubicles, and a bathroom with two baths in it.
Screen between the baths?
No. No, just two bathtubs on plinths. And I was, that was one of the first times I questioned somebody's authority in why are you doing this? And people were bathed two at a time. There was a bath. The first bath, two people went into it. They were washed. They jumped into the next bath and they were rinsed and then dressed. And you only bathed on a Sunday. Any other time that you needed a wash, you had a shower. If they were soiled or anything, but everybody used to stand in a queue, going down to the bathroom with a bundle under their arms and the dressing gowns, and the clothes that they were issued with.
Was the water changed between each bath?
I don't recollect. It would have been, I should think. There was 20, roughly 25, 28 residents on the ward at the time. And I questioned that, and it was rebuked, you know, sort of, don't question my judgment.
So how long did that practice of bathing
continue? Well, I was there on that ward for 3 months, and there was a new charge nurse came along, Jean Lopez. Tony Lopez. It was Jean Lopez's husband, and things started to change, I think. A lot of staff that came to Brindanay, because it was a new hospital, either came from other hospitals or they were already qualified as psychiatric nurse, general nurses. And nursing was one of those things you could continuously do. You do your 3 years general nursing, then you get that done and you could just continually train. And there was a lot of mature adults there rather than just people coming straight from school. So, there's a lot of knowledge in the staff.
Was it perhaps old ways of doing things at that time?
There was a lot of staff were from Oakwood Park. A lot of the things that they had there, they brought with them. A lot of good things, a lot of bad things. This particular ward that I was on, the story, whether it's true or not, I don't know, but people were taken from their wards, put in the hut outside the grounds, and at mealtimes everything was put into one bowl. And rather than eat soup and your main course and your drink, you just had it in one bowl and you finished it and it was done with and everything went. People talked about that frequently, how horrific that was.
You mentioned people being secluded. What would lead to a resident having to spend time in there?
Violence. The side room, there was three wards on the single. One, two, three and four had side rooms upstairs with small little windows in them that looked like cells. They were actually used as bedrooms. They were designed as secluded areas, I presume, but the only two wards that I worked on where people were secluded were Villa 14 and Villa 5. But there was a gentleman who spent his day looking for cigarette butts to eat them, and that was his bedroom, but that wasn't used as a bedroom. But there was maybe the side room off the day room that was used as a secluded room. There was a little character there that used to scratch you all the time, and he'd come behind you, and he'd be like this, and the next thing, oomph, all your arms were scratched to bits. And long after I'd left there, they actually had permission and devised a chair that he was put in, and he was tied down to it. It was like a rustic garden chair, flat arms, and he used to sit on it and he would be tied down to it so that when he scratched somebody, he was put in this chair. And there was a time out. It was recorded, everything was done. It wasn't just something that somebody decided I'm going to do. There's a lot of thought gone into his psychology, psychiatrist and everybody. We need to stop him doing what he's doing. And this chair would used to sit there next to the office.
It's probably impossible for you to answer this question, but do you think that behaviour was down to his environment, or was it just...
A lot of it. Everybody on that ward was unique in what problems they had. There was one lad, Pincher they called him, because he always used to steal food. He used to eat with his arm like so, protecting his food and eating. Like I said, nobody would steal his food, but he'd always pinch little things, and he had a pillow under his bed with all little toys or little screws or whatever he found, and he was given the nickname Pincher. And there was other people. There was some resident had chromosome abnormalities. Other people were born with learning disabilities, and there was the odd one or two people that acquired the disability after birth through an injury or trauma.
So, did you spend all of your time training on that ward?
No, you did 3 months on one ward, and then you went back to school for 2 weeks or a month, and then you went on to another ward.
Were the wards different, each one? Were things done differently on different
wards? Yeah, every charge nurse had their own regime, had their own way of doing things. There was a time I challenged again things because people were becoming lazy. They weren't working. I introduced a group system where 20 residents on a ward, 4 qualified staff, each in charge of a group, and all had staff, and then you did your share of the work. If the staff ratio was low, you'd split it up. It worked well. A lot of charge nurses, the old charge nurses, the philosophy was, I get paid for what I know, not what I do.
So what other wards did you work on in?
I went from there on to Villa 12, which was classed as psychogeriatric, which really wasn't, it was just elderly people. There was a lot of people being Gath and Harrod. There was a character who, for all intents and purposes, was a slave because he was a farmhand. And I used to love listening to his stories. He was mid-Wales mainly. And when he worked on a farm at the end of the season, he would be released, and every year they would be auctioned off, and they'd all go to the farmer's market, and the farmers would buy a person to do the work for them, and they'd just pay them in food and accommodation. All intents and purposes, it was slavery. But
what kind of time period would that have happened?
It would have been 1920s, I think, 1930s.
So he hadn't spent all his time in an institution?
No. He'd some of the people classed as the old tramps, you know. There was a famous tramp in North Wales called John Price. There was a book recently published about him. He avoided the institution.
Were there any female patients on that geriatric ward?
No, there was. The female patients were mixed on Villa 1, 2, 3 and 4. 5 and 6 were male, 7 and 8 were male, 9 was female, 10 was male, 11 was female, 12 was male, 13 was female, 14 was male, 15 and 16 was more like a day unit. We ended up being a EMI unit, and then Villa 19 was a ward that wasn't staffed, really, or there might have been one on, but it was deemed that it didn't need anybody to staff on. And Villa 20 was used as a dining area for people that lived in the community that worked in Brendan Earth, but they went there to eat.
Oh, okay. Were there any female patients who might have been institutionalised because they'd had a baby rather than learning disability?
No, not to my knowledge of that. There was a couple of girls that we had Prader-Willi syndrome. Did to and fro between Ely and Brendan Earth. There were several marriages, one of which I arranged.
Were people, did relationships develop naturally, or were they supported?
A gentleman that was with us had a relationship with just an on-off thing. They used to argue. There was people you went to see before you came here. And there were two characters that I knew from my childhood that lived in a place called Capelychaf in Clonogfawr, who are Ogos, they called them, because they lived in a cave. And the family dispersed and ended up in Brendan Earth. But they'd married before they came to Brendan Earth.
So was if people became engaged or married at the hospital? Did they then live together at the hospital, or were they?
A couple of wards provided accommodation, put a double bed in a room for them, on mainly Villa 3 and 4. And there was a gentleman that was with us, he ex-Rampton resident, he ended up in a house in Pemamaur, Dugabuchi. I ended up being his community nurse. He was married for 4 or 5 years, I think.
Did sexual relationships happen outside work between patients?
There were female residents who developed a relationship with other female residents, yeah.
Given the attitude to same-sex things back in the 70s, how did that sit with people at the hospital then?
There was, to my knowledge, three residents on drugs to suppress the sexual urges. But when you're in Gath and Harad and you've been there for years, it's inevitable it was going to happen.
Had they become a danger to other people then?
There was one person who was admitted into a hospital who was sectioned because of his unhealthy attitude towards people. There was another gentleman who tried to rape somebody in Llandina Junction, and having knowledge of, I know what's wrong with me, I'm going to admit myself into the hospital and it'll stop me being prosecuted, so I'm going to get myself sectioned. And he, as far as I know, he's done nothing since. He's living with the community, with people in Llandina, living a normal life, although sometimes you see him in an electric chair and other times he walks.
So, of those sexual relationships at the hostel that were consensual, and were they encouraged by staff or no?
It's just something that they did naturally. And there was one incident. It was on when I was on Villa 1 and 2. Somebody was called. Oh, it was lunchtime. Come and get your dinner. And somebody used to go knocked on this particular room, and two people were having sex, and the staff innocently just walked in on it. But that person turned it round to make it that they were speaking on them and they weren't. So there was a bit of that happened. There was a Kelly, sadly, was not with us anymore, but he died about 10 years ago. He was suspended on allegations of sexual abuse, which were unfounded, because the girl retracted her accusations.
Do you think that the fact that patients had been encouraged to get married and become engaged, that meant that the other patients there saw it as something that they could aspire to, or something that was normal for people?
I don't think it did. It fizzled out after a while. People were leaving out, going out into the community to live, getting married. Arthur and Madeline, you know, in the house. Bob and Francis. There's nothing that really happen.
Because I think for people with a learning disability today, it would be very unheard of for marriages or sexual relationships to be achievable or something to aspire to today. And probably quite surprising for people to hear that it would have happened 30, 40 years ago.
Mm.
What about the routine of the patients? So what would happen? I know you were there for a long time and it may have altered over time, but what was the general day like?
Get up in the morning.
What kind of time?
Depends who was on. You had to lie in on a weekend, Saturday, Sundays, weekdays. Some wards, the night staff were expected to get the residents up and dressed and the beds made by the time the staff came in. Other wards, the staff, depending on what the staff ratio, if you saw, there's not many people in, or somebody'd phoned in sick, you'd jump in and start getting people up.
And how many patients were there on a ward, is it?
25.
And how many 20. Of you would there be to get people up? And
Roughly 4 a shift, if you were lucky. Maybe 5, if you were really lucky. It's when Project 2000 came in, where the student nurses disappeared. That's when sort of like the staffing levels got reduced a little bit, because you know, you relied on those student nurses. They were a useful workforce to have, and then that stopped for an initial period.
So how long would you have to get people up and dressed?
Breakfast we delivered about 8. Those that worked, male workshops, female workshops, went to work for 9. You encouraged people to shave themselves if they could. Everybody had their own razors. They either had wet razors, or I used to like wet shaving. When I was on the geriatric psychogeri ward, people used to enjoy having a wet shave. It was something they were used to. A lot of people were very nervous of a buzzy thing in their face. It sort of unnerved them.
What was for breakfast?
It was cooked breakfast. Cereal in the beginning, cup of tea. When I was told my wife worked then, she was sort of... She was horrific thought of when you make tea, you get this massive teapot, loose leaf tea, about a cup full, and sugar and milk, and then you pour it into the cup, and that's how you made the tea. It wasn't thought of that. What if somebody wants a cup and saucer? So that was introduced after people sort of saying, hey, look, this practice has got to stop. And then each table then had its own teapot, milk, sugar. And things improved over the years because people came in, people had vision, they could see that this isn't the way to look after people, let's be normal. But then staff used to go out and get Chinese and eat it in front of the residents. That wasn't the done thing, and it was stopped. But we used to go out to Chinese restaurants. The odd occasion when we used to go check the monies, see how much money they had. Ooh, everybody's got plenty of money. Go and get them, cancel the meal that night, and everybody get a Chinese.
Did it? Was it cooked breakfast every day?
Yeah.
Did that change at all? But towards the end of your time there,
I think it did. It went on to more continental breakfast, toast and cereal. Budget cuts, I believe.
Yeah, not health then.
No, nothing health wise.
So was the food cooked on in the ward, or was it cooked in the central?
No, it was cooked in the main kitchen, which was also doubled up as a staff canteen, and it was put into trolleys, and the trolleys were put in carts, and porters used to drive the vehicles up to the thing, and two trolleys used to come on the wards. The food was decent. It wasn't rubbish. You know, there was a case of a house in Clamavechen where people were given fish fingers to eat and toast for breakfast, and that place got shut down. You know, and people wanted to come to Brendanair to work so they could get a decent meal. It was decent food.
So those patients who would go off to the workshops, what kind of thing would they do?
It varied. They had, I can't remember, I was thinking about it the other day, that the manager, I can't remember what his name was, but some of them, they used to secure contracts for doing things. There was two I remembered, was packing tennis, like a sponge ball and two rackets into a netting and put them in boxes. And there was a firm in Bangor that made car parts. It was the sills for cars, and the burr was on the... thing. It was dangerous, so Brendanair had them, and they were issued with files and gloves. They were put into, and the residents used to file them down. And there's one character, he was blind, and he'd come to, the first time I met him, he said, he'd walk up from the workshops up to Villa 12, no problem. And he said, please, can you help me? Can you get the splinters out of my hands? And I said, yeah, of course I can. I said, how did you do that, John? Cutting firewood, he goes. And I thought, no, what do you mean cutting firewood? He just has vision of an axe and the thing. And what they did was they got a big block of wood, put a cold chisel upside down, handle into the wood. John would feel for the wood. The wood was cut into blocks for him. He would feel for it, put the wood on the cold chisel, feeling bam, bam, bam. And he'd make little bundles of firewood. You know, people used to come for fire and wire to buy them.
Did the patients get... a sense of worth, or do they see it as a job in the same way that we would see the work that we do?
Yeah, the thing, they get paid. I can't remember if they got paid a lot, but they got paid. The building had caught fire. I think they turned it into more of an education unit. There was a gentleman of Villa 1 and 2, Malwyn Williams. He was the further education officer and sports officer. He used to do things, maths and numeracy and reading and writing stuff, those that wanted to or could. They used to make garden benches and sell them, bird tables and things like that. Some of the girls, I think, used to make mats at one time. I only spent 3 months. I had to prove myself. I was working on a children's ward. There were children up to the age of 10, I think, about 10, 11, severely disabled, couldn't move at all. Everyone was in a chair. And it was a Sunday night, and the last bus, I finished work at 9 o'clock, and the last bus went at 9:05. Well, there used to be a shortage of qualified staff, so if that was the case, and there was two of you on, and there wasn't a qualified staff in another ward, that qualified staff would have to go and do the drugs on another ward, and that was it was very frequent. You used to have to go and do 3, maybe 4 drug rounds on other wards. And this particular, I'm not going to make this bus. And I was living in Bangor, which was 15 miles away. So I just wrapped tissues around all these children's necks and gave them all their drinks. And then I just threw the tissues away, voila, top's clean. And the ward sister thought I'd purposely not give them a drink so that I could catch the bus. And I went to the bin and I proved, look, these are the tissues, the thing, they wouldn't have it. And I was given a bad report. And I was in front of the senior tutor and told me that my position there was in jeopardy because these allegations were made. And I said, well, I'm sorry, I don't have that, I'm not having it. So I proved my worth because I just flew through the remaining time I was there, and proved that I was worthy of qualifying and working there. It was just one off thing. It was a horrible experience.
Did the female patients do similar work to the male patients in the workshops?
No. I was mainly with Bill, his name was. He was the man that did the chairs. I didn't really go over to the girl side. I think they used to do rip material up, I think they used to do, and make, rag mats and things like that. But just one bit I don't remember, really.
So would people come back to the workshop for lunch, from the workshop to the ward for lunch?
Yeah, they'd all go back to the ward for lunch, and then they'd go back, and then the end of the day, one gentleman one day, he got his days mixed up, couldn't get in and smashed every single window in the building. Every single one of them.
Because he wanted to go back to the workshop?
He was a very temperamental. He used to smoke pigtail, a specific type of tobacco. And if he couldn't have that, he wouldn't be a very happy lad. He used to go a bit ballistic.
So what would happen to those patients who couldn't go to workshops? What would they do?
Go on trips. There used to be a lot of wards had weekly trips, a weekly bus trip. Villa 12 in particular used to go to two pubs, one in Rachib, and the minute you walked into the pub in Rachib, locals put your hand in your pocket and they'd buy them all a drink. It was absolutely brilliant. You'd look forward to that.
Because I was going to ask, what was the reaction from the public, from these
in residents? The beginning, when I first went to work in Llanfairpwll was dry. The pubs weren't open on a Sunday. But we used to go to the Pen y Bryn and say, well, you're new in the village, where are you from? So you bring the nair, you puff. And I thought, whoa, hang on. Just because I'm nursing doesn't make me a puff, And it was that attitude. And a lot of people despised the place. But it was the biggest employer in the area, from Bangor to Conwy.
Well, why did they despise it?
Why did they despise the MSU? They thought something bad was coming to their village and they didn't want it. But in the whole time Bryn Mawr was there, I don't think anybody's life was threatened. But in the old Bryn Mawr, a psychiatrist admitted his friend into the hospital because he lost his faculties. And when he thought he was better, he went for a walk with him one day down to the beach, and the patient murdered him. Yep. So, you know, nothing like that happened. Mm. That's another thing where we used to build a five. There used to be a beach hut down on the beach, and it was just a building with beach huts and then a courtyard and a big fence around the front of it and steps going down to the beach. So we, as a group, with the other five, used to go down there through the woods, through this big gate, and then lock everybody up and take two at a time down into the beach when staff ratios permitted it. And we took the whole ward one day, and we had to come back quick because he started to drink from the puddle. They became ill, so we had to come back. And that stopped it because they thought we went, you know, doing the right thing. Somebody burnt it down, actually. It wasn't used afterwards. We used to go to the pub.
How much would they be allowed to drink?
A pint. There was a cafe on the prom. It's still there now, big, the pavilion. And the owner of that said, "You're not bringing those here, go away." That was in mid-70s. So we boycotted, all the staff boycotted him, and we didn't go there. We used to go up to Village Inn, Castle Hotel, and Rachib, the ship launch in Bangor when we were on a bus trip. And then things progressed, then we started going on holidays.
Where would you go?
There was a place called the Derbyshire Miners in Rhyl, and there was us and St Margaret's Hospital in Birmingham. And it was a holiday camp that took about 300 people, which was built for the miners of Derbyshire. But we took it over for 1 week every year, and Bryn Mawr would take half of its residents, maybe, and St Margaret's would equal that amount. And we used to have talent shows, and you know, it was brilliant. But then people wanted to go further afield, and so, or start going abroad. And I thought, no, I didn't do that, didn't go abroad. And we had an exchange one year with, I don't know if you're familiar with it, Claypenny in York.
Oh, OK.
Yeah, we did an exchange. One ward came to us, and they swapped drivers halfway. And then we went up to York, and then they came down to us. We had a better time in York because they looked after us better than they did here, because there wasn't much to do in North Wales at the time. You didn't have your slate quarry and stuff.
So they'd go on holiday to another
hospital? Another hospital. I enjoyed it. It was great.
You mentioned earlier residents transferred from Ely, and you know, we've heard about a group of people coming up from Ely. Why were they transferred between hospitals?
I'm not sure why, because I didn't ask, but there was a girl, Prader-Willi syndrome. It took four of us to go down to take her to Ely, and it was the time in Ely where the infamous hosing down happened. Are you familiar with that?
Well, we're familiar with the 69 inquiry, but not the hosing down.
Yeah, there was a compound in the back, and the staff there had used a fire hose and to wash people down with. It was on the back of that, and we did an exchange, but I can't remember who we swapped this lady for. But we nearly lost her because we went down to Garth Angharad, and our car broke down on the way down, and then we had to borrow Garth Angharad's minibus. And then the back doors of the bus opened, and we just turned round and looked, and there she was, sat in a seat looking out. Do I jump? Do I escape? And but she didn't. But when we got to Ely, we'd done away with our white coats at this point. When we got to Ely, these two massive big men came out with white coats and picked her up and took her away.
What year was that, roughly?
79, 80.
Did you go into Ely?
Yeah, we when
I had did it strike you compared to Brennan Air?
Just massive, big institution. Because we did a couple of stints in Denby. We went to Mail 6, I think it was. We provided people in Brennan Air from Denby. They sort of progressed from there, sort of coming to Brennan Air. It was just a miniature Denby, really, I thought. I wasn't that impressed with it. And then it was Hentel Castle as well, and that place. And
so did the other hospitals have a reputation amongst those of you at Brennan Ayers?
Some did, because Brennan Ayers never made the headlines. I think it was Calderstones in Lancashire?
I'm familiar with that one.
That was a big one. Something happened there. I can't remember what it was. That was in the 80s. No, it was nothing. Anything. There was a couple of little incidents happened, and it was brushed under the carpet and thrown away. Mm. We'd bring in there, didn't need bad publicity. There's nothing bad happening there. Like, you know, it was the time to move on from your old institutions, and bring in there was the way forward. But there's a lot of things. The J report, when it came out, that was actually in situ when I started training, and it was kicked out. And then it was, all of a sudden, the all-wheel strategy came in. And when we read that, it was the J report retitled.
What was the effect of the strategy on the hospital?
Staff were worried. They were losing their jobs. A lot of staff were coming in. Trevi Cymru staff were coming in to basically take people's work away from them. But it wasn't just that. It was the whole nursing thing was changing. They were doing away with SENs, because, you're familiar with made-up SENs?
No.
Some SENs with time served were actually nursing assistants, and because they'd served X number of years, they were made up into SENs. There's one person that I know of that's still alive that was one of those people. But they weren't allowed to give injections. They could give drugs out and they could be in charge of the ward, but they weren't allowed to give injections. Mm.
So how did your role change at the hospital over the period you were there, from qualifying?
I was one of the few people who appealed when the grading system came in, and I worked on Villa 12 at the time with a male charge nurse and no staff nurse, and we basically ran the ward together, and I was miffed that I was getting paid as a SEN, but I was doing a staff nurse's job, and we were graded. I was graded E, and I appealed and I got an F. And I go, what's a back pay? And a lot of people weren't happy about it. There was a couple of us had it. But, you know, they were abusing us. You know, they were expecting us to do a staff nurse's job and only paying us an SEN's wage. You know, if anything happened, you know, in the end, they took the way the drug had all out of the SEN. They weren't allowed to get drugs out. And they had to convert them.
So how did things at the hospital change during your time there?
Drugs changed. Drugs became more improved. Have you heard of paraldehyde?
Yes.
The infamous paraldehyde. Once I've had to give that. And the individual was on 10 milligrams, and you split it up, and he woke up halfway through the second dose. And I honestly thought he'd gone. He was in status. He was.
What circumstances would lead you to have to use paraldehyde?
Somebody gone into status epilepticus. They hadn't recovered from three. If they had three or more, the criteria was if they had three or more fits within an hour, and they weren't going to recover, you could administer this. And the dosages were 4, 5, 8, 10. Anything that was 4 or 10, you had to split it and massage it, because it had to be given in a glass syringe.
Why did it have to be given in?
To melt the plastic. And if you didn't massage it in, it would just rot the buttock away.
Oh, it was injected in the behind, is it?
So, yeah. Actually, I've was looking into it the other week, that it's still in use in some areas as a liquid form.
Did it smell?
Yes, it did smell, and some people were addicted to it. There was a couple of the old charge nurses who were known to come in on the days off, and sort of just the smell.
Was it addictive substance, or was it just the smell? They
just
liked
the smell.
This?
Just the smell. It happened to a friend of mine who was a theatre technician in St David's Hospital, and in those days you worked for a year before you had annual leave, and you got a day for every month you worked, and he was working. He was checking the gas and air, and when he had at the end of his year, he had a holiday and he became ill. And what it was, he was smelling the gas and air, and he was addicted to it without realising it. Mm. And I presume that would happen with these, with paraldehyde. Mm. Some people liked it. I just knew who had been on duty if paraldehyde had been used, because you could smell it. Mm. It's like garlic, it just absorbed it through the body.
Was anyone resettled from the hospital when you were working there?
There was a house up in the village where Patrick moved to. He was settled there. Bob was settled. Somebody you've seen today was resettled.
So what was the atmosphere like in the hostel when people were moving out? Were they pleased to be going?
No, people didn't want to go. That's one of the most ardent disapprover of being housed out in the community was a gentleman called Joe Beck. And there's no way Joe was going. He knew he had one eye, and there's no way Joe was going out into the community, never. And last November my mother was dying in hospital with dementia, and one of the last words to me were, "That man next door, can you stop him making the noise, please?" And he was just, I stayed with her that night, and I went to ask the nurse, I'm sorry to do this, I said, but, you know, my mother's having palliative care and she's on her way out. Can you please move this gentleman? And I looked, and it was bloody Joe. And he passed away, sadly, about 3-4 months after that. Yeah. Most of the people that I knew that were actually relocated were into the cemetery in the village.
They wouldn't go back to where they came from originally then?
There was protest on some villages. Penindreidraeth, there was one gentleman who went to the village, just didn't want him back in the village. A lot of people went to Wrexham, not even where they originated from. So.
And those who passed away, were they taken back to the county their families were in, or were they? Is it just
no, a lot
buried?
Of people. There was a case in question. I can't remember what happened to him. There was a knock on the door one day, and this old lady came, and she said, "I've been told I can come down here. You've got a resident here named Sammy." And I says, "Yes." I says, "Can I come and see him?" And she told me the story. And when she was a little girl, she lived in Conwy with her mother and Sammy, and trains used to go to Carnarvon in those days. And every Monday morning, Sammy would be put on the train with his mother and this woman walked down to the station, put him on the train, and every Friday they'd go down to the station and Sammy'd come home for the weekend. One Friday they didn't go to the station. 50-odd years later, she's looking for him. And she came and she found him. And it was just the lump I had in my throat when she saw him, when she said, "He hasn't changed." And you can see him now, his nose, and he's like a little mouse, he was. And I think he knew her. And that was just so sad. It was, your mum couldn't cope anymore. So we just let him go.
Did the patients at the hospital have many visitors from family?
A few did, not everybody. When I was on Villa 14, obviously Villa 12, psychogeriatric, they were all geriatrics, probably didn't have families. There was a little gentleman called Wayne Dolman, Michael Burns, Ken, Alan, Derek. I'm not sure if he's still alive. They had family. They'd periodically visit.
A Saturday of the week? Or?
No, just randomly. There was one lad, his mother, who was of the Jewish origin, from Wrexham, and she used to come on a set day every month. It was like the last Thursday of every month, she used to come down and see him. And sit there in the day room and have a cup of tea with him. And
so the family were allowed onto the ward?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, you never stopped anybody coming onto the ward. If they, you know, a lot of staff used to bring their kids to the ward. You know, I introduced my family to the people I looked after, even when I came, because after I'd left Brendan Air, that I befriended a gentleman with Down syndrome, and I used to bring him home for tea with us every Tuesday. And I taught my family, you know, treat everybody as equal, and they do. And it's you know, something I felt that I've done good for them, not to, because we used to get stared at. Sometimes when you walk down the streets with somebody with a disability, you've got to hold their hand, you've got to link arms, you've got to make sure they're safe. They're not going to walk into the road. They feel safe. And there's nothing wrong in it. It was just when you walked around the ground, you had a wheelchair and you used to have people either side of you clinging on to you, because we were going out into the big world, you know. Mm. And they felt safe.
Do you think that those who are resettled from the hospital, how do you think their lives are different now?
They seem happy, the ones I've seen. There was one grumpy little fella, Lloyd, in the wheelchair. He was terrible. But when I saw him in that out, he looked happy. Because there was a lad, I don't know if he's still alive, he went to Festiniogwe, and he was happy. And sometimes when you see people, and my name's distinctive, and they remember me, and, oh, nice to see you and that, but, you know, it was nice that I've remembered for good things.
What have they gained from leaving the hospital?
Independence, in some aspects. I'm not sure if it's all been good.
I was going to say, do you think they've lost anything?
They shouldn't have done, really. Maybe comradeship in the people they grew up with for 20-odd years. You know, but a lot of people hated each other. There's a lot of people with autism who didn't give a monkey's with it, who was next to them or not, like, you know, so as long as they were fed, they were warm, they were comfortable, and nobody invaded their space, they didn't care where they went. Mm. They'd go with the flow.
What was the state of the Welsh language in the hospital?
Bad as it is now. But a lot of the staff that came over were English, because they'd come from away, you know, new hospital, new. A lot of the people are still around.
Were any of the patients solely Welsh speakers, or were they bilingual?
There was one or two. There was one lad from Llanberis, Ivor. He preferred speaking in Welsh. Mm.
Did it affect him, the fact that many of the staff couldn't speak Welsh?
No.
No?
No, I don't think so.
What do you think why have you decided to be interviewed today, and what do you think, is there any importance in people sharing their story?
I didn't agree with what happened and the way they did with Brendan Earth, but it was inevitable.
What didn't you agree with?
People that I looked after did not want to go out into the community. One individual in particular, when I was leaving, he wasn't happy that I was leaving. He did some nasty things to people and to himself, but he respected me because I was firm with him and I told him what I thought of him, and he respected me, and we got on like a house on fire. But he went and put himself on fire. And I was the second person on scene, and I had to sit with him in hospital he went in the ambulance and I followed on my motorbike, and he was sitting there with his smouldering clothes stuck to him, on the side of his head, his clothes, his legs, And for the remaining 2 weeks or so that I was still in the hospital, I had to change his dressings. I don't know if that was a protest or that he didn't want to go out. And the strange thing with that one, he was moved because they couldn't look after him. He just, you know, Bryn and Air wasn't geared for that type of person. He was moved to Northumberland. I can't remember what the name of the place was. And I got into trouble because I was on a course and the gentleman that was conducting the course said something unpleasant about the staff in Bryn Mawr and that it was costing them £120,000 a year because they couldn't look after the patients. And I just stood up and walked out. And I thought, I'm sorry, I'm not that. You're referring to me. Mm. You know, I've looked after that individual. I know who you're talking about. And I was in Tesco's in Llandina Junction shortly after it opened. And this voice stood behind me. Hello, Eddie. How are you? And it was this individual. The day he was released, his father had gone to Northumberland to pick him up. And the first stop he made was Tesco's in Junction to go and buy tobacco. And he walked in and the first person he saw was me. I was so scary. It's the way he told me about it, you know. And I thought, bloody hell. I lost my health because of the thing. It made me ill. There was stuff that had... It was the transformation of the thing. That's why I got out, really, to go and work in the community, to become a community nurse, because I felt I could do more. Mm. I was wrong, because I ended up doing 30 miles a day going to teach somebody how to tie shoelaces. You know, I'm worth more than that. Mm. I want to do more than that. But something happened in Bryn Mawr that changed it dramatically. And I can't remember the year, but... We were going on holiday one year. Or somebody was going on holiday one year. And he had a problem with mucus. And we wanted to borrow an aspirator to take with us. I think we were going on a canal holiday or something like that. So that we could suck the thing to stop him choking. Because he used to choke quite badly. Anyways, the system changed where a nursing officer... from another hospital came in and undermined the decision of a charge nurse, which caused a massive problem. That person then wanted to pass a vote of no confidence in this nursing officer. The whole hospital was summoned, all those that could go into the hall. Have you heard of this?
No.
The whole hospital was called into the hall. And Colin, at the time, who was in charge of the hospital, basically said, do you know what you are doing? Because if you... It's the only blot on the history of the place, in my opinion. Do you know what you're doing? Because if you do what you're going to do, every staff's going to be investigated because they deemed there's a problem here. And all it was one person's decision to do something that the other one disagreed on. That system then... changed the whole structure of nursing officers were done away with it. Charge nurses became senior nurses and the whole system changed. And then discipline went out the window because new people, when a nursing officer walked into a room, you stood up, you called him Mr. But a nursing officer called me Mike. And familiarity became involved and people... just became too familiar with their seniors, and it changed a lot of people and their attitudes, and things became a little bit slack, and I didn't like it. Having been in the army when I left school, I was a bit of a disciplinarian, and the old staff that worked from the old hospitals, discipline, gave you respect, and that just went. The whole system changed, all because of this one incident.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with me before we end?
No. Well, there's lots happened. Lots of things happened. I could write a book about it, I presume, but I don't know how it would be received. There's a lot of people still alive that aren't working in Bryn Mawr that are there. People want to forget that they worked there.
do you think some staff feel, I don't know if shame's the right word, but would rather rather not have their name associated with the hospital, or?
No, they've done their time. They just want to forget about it and retire. There's too many people retired and not lived to enjoy their retirement. One thing I didn't like about the village, there was this particular woman. She was a right gossiper, she was. But you couldn't walk down into the village and you'd be asked, when are you working? Are you on? Where are you going? You know, have you heard this about, you know, you just wanted to, that's why when I became a community nurse, I moved to the other side of Carnarvon to live, and I sort of got myself together and for a while and realised that the village is Bryn Mawr. Mm-hmm. Most of the staff that worked in the hospital lived in the village at this point. You couldn't do anything. Everybody wanted to know your business. But there were good times. There were excellent times. There were some not so excellent times. Met my first wife there. Divorced my first wife there. Met my second wife there. But in the Nath had the highest rate of divorce of any employer in the whole of North Wales at one time.
Why do you think that was the case?
Staff working together, male females working together, relationships developing. It's male female staff going on holidays together.
What do you think the public's perception of Bryn Mawr is? And is it an accurate one, do you think?
No, there used to be this right hypocritical woman she was. She sold shoes in the village. She made a bloody living out of Bryn Mawr, buying clothes and the clothes shops that were there. Like, you know, she made a bloody good living out of it, because we used to, when those that could buy shoes used to go to her to buy shoes, she was the only one there. And she was anti Bryn Mawr. And then when she heard about the MSU, she was anti the MSU. I said, it's an employer. But somebody bloody escaped from her within the first few weeks, wasn't it? But the theory is that if anybody's going to escape, they'll run away.
Mm.
They don't want to be there, with the exception of one person. Mm. Two people have, in my time, escaped from Bryn Mawr and died as a result of not being found, one into the sea and one up the mountains.
Mm.
And they're just sad cases. They're just unfortunate. It's something I've been wanting to talk at people. There's somebody I work with now. He worked with the brain trauma people in Northampton, and he wants to go back into it. And I thought at one point, because I retired on health grounds, and I felt bad that it done me bad, because the community, the staff that I worked with, my senior nurse, she wasn't very nice to me. She criticised all my work towards the end, and she did some things that were unpleasant. And then I've retired on health grounds, and a bloody month after I went, she went. And I thought, bitch, I would have stayed on. I probably would have sorted out, because people that are still actually community nurses now, because I remember when I went for the interview, do you know why I asked you to become a community nurse, to work with us? Do you know why I wanted you? And he says, no, I said, why? He said, because you're the sort of person that I'd like to come to my house and talk to. And that just made me feel so good. And I thought, I did, and I connected with all my clients. I was told by a charge nurse who was retired, there's a patient on this ward, there will come a time where you will want to kill him. Walk away. This will happen. I don't know when it's going to happen to you, but it will happen. I think I was there about a week, and this man drove me mad. And he was, it was all about underpants. There wasn't one pair of underpants, and they all had the little threads that came out on them. And he, not one suited him. He had to have a pair of underpants that didn't have a thread on them. He just drove me. Yeah, it was good days. I'd do it all again. Mm. I'd go back there again if I had my life back. My mother didn't want me to go there.
No.
But I'm glad I did it. There's one incident that I upset people, but I gave somebody a better quality of life as a result of my actions. There was a gentleman who, during the war, he was conscripted, and he was in Manchester, and he was called to take the bodies of children out of a building that had been hit by a bomb.
Mm.
And when they found him, he was gone. Mm. He was just, but for some reason, he was discharged from the army, A1 fit, which the army said there was nothing wrong with him.
Mm.
But from that day on to the day he died, he was a vegetable, for what I want of a better word.
PTSD, was it?
It was. And I got in touch with the Robbers' Legion, and we put a claim in for a war pension. And I was told not to do it by the psychiatrist because he was deemed to be suffering from hereditary schizophrenia. And it's going back to one of your questions of his mother was institutionalised and his sister was institutionalised. Mm. His mother died of a brain hemorrhage, of not a known cause, and his sister was institutionalised because she was a child out of wedlock.
Mm.
And I won my case, and he was given £15,000 and £104 a week, if I'm correct.
Mm.
Sorry, £104 a month pension for the rest of his life. Mm. And that is my biggest achievement that I've done for an individual. I improved his quality of life financially, and he was able to go places and do things, and things were bought for him.
Mm.
But it divided the family, which is unfortunate, because they all thought that the families were mad, and they weren't.
Yeah. Mm.
They were a victim of the system, which is unfortunate.
Mm.
But I don't know what's become of them, but he's probably passed away now, but he didn't need to be the way he was, and he was treated badly.
Mm.
And so was I, because I challenged somebody's diagnosis.
Mm.
And I was told by colleagues of the psychiatrist, leave it alone, don't touch it. You're wrong. And I wasn't wrong, I was right.
Well, thank you very much.
Oral history isn't necessarily fact or the unbiased truth. It is a person's truth. It may clash with official records or even other people's accounts that we collect. But for each person we interview, it is their experience and as valid as anyone else's. This podcast was produced by Nikki Rook and is a Mancap Cymru production.